All right, if you want to take your Bibles and turn to John chapter 1, verse 1, where I'm going to start. Called this one the tabernacle. Now, this is really a small part, what I'm going to do today, of a bigger study on the tabernacle. But seeing how we're here at the Feast of Tabernacles, I thought this is a good time to go through this. So the total picture of what the tabernacle in the wilderness was there for spiritually and physically, I'm not even going to really do more than just touch a little bit, give just a little bit of insight today, and maybe even ask more questions than I give answers for today. But I want to bring out a couple things that it was for and is for today. John chapter 1 verse 1 says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it." But if you look, you know, this is talking about creation. This takes back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. "But when Jesus formed the dirt from the ground and blew the breath of life into Adam's nostrils, they were not only creating mankind, they were creating a family that would grow to fill the earth and later would grow to fill the kingdom. It was their desire to commune and dwell with mankind, not just to have a possession, like people possess things. Go over to somebody's house, and most people have something. You know, it might be up on a shelf somewhere, or it might be on display somewhere. It could be material, tangible things. Like sometimes you see these little figurines in people's houses. They have a little, I know Mary's mother had a china cabinet, and it was a very pretty china cabinet. It had rounded glass and it was antique, and she had these little figurines in there. If you walked into her house and opened the cabinet up and started pulling these out and started looking at them and flipping them over, she got a little bit of nervous because, you know, they were precious to her. They meant something. It's like, so if we do this to people, you just walk in their house and you see something looks like they got it, and you go over there and start grabbing it and messing with it and say, "Hey, that's my stuff." You know, we're not God's stuff. You know, I have 6 billion possessions walking the face of the earth, and that's just humankind, not counting all the animals and the sea creatures and everything else. The purpose of what he was doing isn't to make stuff. There was another purpose that was behind it. It was to have a relationship. Let's skip down a little bit and look at verse 10. It says, talking about Jesus, says, "He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God." I'm stopping here for a second because this is very important. I know back in our minds almost everybody understands this, but I don't know how much really think about it or realize it. "As many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God." That means that's your right. That's your heritage. That's something you can claim. I think a lot of people are afraid to claim that. We all see television movies, go to the theater, you see something, and somebody inevitably in some of the movies, they stand up and they say, "Do you know who I am?" You know, when I was talking earlier about Satan attacking you, Satan trying to come against us, Satan trying to destroy you. We need to have each other's back. We need to, but ultimately we need to strengthen each other so that we can have the relationship with God, because that's where the real protection comes from. When Satan tries to attack you, you can say, "Get behind me. Do you know who I am? I am a child of the living God." If I want to get Armando or any other man in here with children, but if I want to get Armando, he's very mild-mannered. I've seen him upset a few times, but I've never seen him lose it. But if I want to see him lose it, all I got to do is go over there and start messing with his children like I'm going to harm them in some way, and he's going to lose it, and the fight is on. If we're God's children, who would you rather have having your back? Now, I'd want them both, but if I had to choose between Armando and God, I'd rather have God watching my back than Armando. We have that right, that privilege, that opportunity. And so many of us, maybe we don't really believe it ourselves. Like, yeah, I know that concept, or yeah, that theory, it's out there, but you don't believe it like he's your father that's going to protect you. Now, yes, sometimes there are things we have to go through so we learn something. Just like if you ask anybody in here, the children, is there anything your parents did that, you know, you didn't like? And inevitably, some of those things will be, they let them go through that experience. They told them, "Don't touch the stove, it's hot," 45 times, and they didn't get it. So finally, it wasn't really hot, and they let them touch it and got burned, because that's the only way that they could learn what hot really meant. He gave the right to become children of God to those who believe in his name, who were born not of the blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. It's your destiny. So what's God doing here? You know, after creation, 4,000 years later, Jesus or Yeshua or, you know, different ways to pronounce it, whatever. We all know who I'm talking about. That's what I love about God. He's not only bilingual, not only trilingual. He understands all languages. He knows what you're talking about. He came to the earth to become flesh and blood, to become one of us. And how does the Bible describe him living with us? See, I like John chapter 1. I love Leviticus. I love reading through that. But John chapter 1, that's one of my favorite chapters, because it talks about creation and a lot of insight. And it says in verse 14, it says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." I like to talk about the Word and what does that mean, and, you know, get into the Torah readings and why do they refer to Jesus as the Word. I'm not going to get into all of that today, but what I want to dwell on or talk about today is the Word. It says the Word became flesh and dwelt. I'm going to talk about that word dwelt. So I looked it up. It's a Greek word, shekinu. It's 4637 in Strong's. It means to tent or encamp. In other words, figuratively to occupy or to reside, as God did in the tabernacle of old, a symbol of protection and communion. So that's what Jesus was doing when he came to earth to dwell with us. He tabernacled with us for communion with us, interaction with us, a relationship with us. Why did God choose to reveal himself in the way that he did? Now think about this. Sometimes it makes you nuts when your kids say, "Why is the sky blue? Why is the sun bright? Why are there clouds? Why are there..." But that's not necessarily a bad thing. Why did God do it the way he did it? Because if we can ask those questions and say, we know how he did it, if we can ask the question and say, why did he do it that way? Think about the different possibilities. Well, number one, it was the best way to do it. So if it was the best way to do it, what is he trying? Is it possible? Now, I know it's a multifaceted question, but is it possible that he was trying to teach us something in the way which he chose to do it? Is there a lesson there? Is there something we can learn? Why did he choose Israel to go into Egypt with such honor? The family of Joseph, and then become slaves. Think about that for a minute. You know, every year at Passover, we talk about the great miracles that God did, and nothing wrong. We're supposed to be doing now that. But I mean, think about it. He has them go, you know, here's Joseph. He goes in a very, you know, unceremonial way, you know, sold off into slavery. But eventually the story happens and all of Joseph's family comes into Israel. And think about it, if you were there, if you were part of that family, a cousin, an uncle, whatever. Here's Joseph, second to Pharaoh, and your family comes in and the honor and the position, and how do you leave? 180 degrees opposite. But even in doing that, he chose that they were supposed to leave the way they left. The miracles that we talk about each year. Yeah, it's, he, you know, and I'm not answering all of these questions today. I just want to, the theme I want to touch on is, what's God doing? What's this journey that we're all on? And the way that he's chosen the journey to happen. Because in each one of our lives, you can take in the look in the Bible, look at Israel, and you can see the things, the trials, the triumphs, and everything they went through. That's happening to us, but on a smaller scale. What's he doing with us? Why did we observe Passover and the other holy days, like tabernacles, we're here right now, the way we do it? Why are the commandments in there that we should be doing this? What is he trying to teach us, and what are we supposed to learn? And ultimately, what's the goal? Why the failures and the triumphs that are recorded in the Bible about Israel? What's God doing? What are we supposed to learn from it? People go and see a movie and it's just a movie. They come out of it and it maybe makes them feel good, or it makes them feel sad, or gets them all pumped up if it's an Arnold Schwarzenegger action movie, and you know, whatever it is, you don't really get a whole lot of that. When you go through the Bible and you read it and you study it and you see it, it's not like going to a movie. It's not like just to make you feel good. There's a reason for it, a purpose for it, and it's important. And I don't know anybody that knows all these answers, so it's not like I'm giving you a teaser and then I'm going to give you the answer at the very end of it. Nobody has figured it out that as a human being, other than Jesus knew what the purpose was, but he had a little advantage over all of us, okay? We're all going through this tabernacle step by step. And I want to start with the tabernacle in the wilderness. The way God designed it. Like I said, I can't go through all of that today. I think it took, 12 or 13 Sabbaths. And we just touched on it. You know, it didn't answer all the questions. We just touched on it. But it's important, even down to the design and everything he said to do about it. I'll tell you that it was a picture of Jesus, 100%. Everything in the tabernacle had to do with him. The design, the materials used, the order of things, 100%. Now, it's ironic to me that most of the Christian churches in the world, they look and they say, well, that's got nothing to do with Jesus. That's all abolished and nailed to the cross and done away with. And realistically, even if we look at the Sabbath groups, too big of a percentage of them don't see him in that either. It's not only a picture of Jesus, but it's also of ourselves too. It's a picture of the church and us individually. It was a real place in real time, but everything about it was prophetic. The physical things were there. It had a practical purpose. It was used for worshiping God. But every physical thing also has spiritual purpose and a prophetic purpose. And it has meaning to us today. I want to start, although that's not where the tabernacle, if you go through and you start reading about it in Exodus, where it started. But I want to start with the high priest. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 8, verse 1. And I want to start there because our Messiah is our high priest. And he dwells in a tabernacle in heaven. Somebody asked a question, Jason, or somebody said something about what's Jesus doing today. Well, he's up in a tabernacle in heaven. And that tabernacle that was on earth was a copy of the tabernacle that's in heaven. So if you want to kind of get a mental picture of what might be up there, go through. There's no way to go through the writings. Now, John has talked about this before. How many years on the bench, John? Yes, you. 43 years as a master jeweler, creating, working with precious metals and stones and creating things. And he's talked about the instructions that it gives you in the Bible. If somebody came to him and said, make this and here's the instructions, he couldn't begin to make it. He wouldn't know where to start. So I'm not going to tell you you're going to understand every little detail because it's not enough there. It also says that he showed Moses in a vision what was in heaven. And then okay, oh, now I see it. John said, if I see a picture of it or a drawing one time, that's all he's got to do is see it one time, then he can make it with some instructions. So we can't get a perfect picture, but we can get a rough idea. We can get a concept of what's going on in heaven. This earthly tabernacle is a copy of the heavenly tabernacle, and that's where our high priest is today. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 1, it says, now this is the main point of the things we are saying. Okay, let me give you a hint. Talked about this before. When somebody tells you, they're going to give you an explanation of something, and they say, this is the main point. What do you think the next thing out of their mouth, or whatever they write to you, or whatever, is? It's the main point. It's like, don't miss this. This is what I'm trying to get across to you. So it says, this is the main point of the things we are saying. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord erected and not man. Well, see, physically there's something going on when this book is written, because if you're a believer and this religious system in the first century is corrupt and you understand it, and they just killed God's son and the leaders there, you think some of you people in this room have left churches for valid reasons? You know, things have gone wrong. How about they killed God's son? You know, some people leave because they're offended, or they're mad at somebody, or they really can't get along with somebody or whatever. That's nothing compared with they've killed the Messiah, the Son of God. they had a valid reason for saying, you know, maybe there's something wrong over there. And I think what's used against them even is, you, what do? You have no high priest. Because the main point of this part of the book of Hebrews, and I think a big part of the Hebrews in general, is we have a high priest. In fact, our high priest is in God's tabernacle that ain't made by the hands of men. It's pure. You only got a replicate, a knockoff, a copy. The original is where our high priest ministers and operates from. And actually, when you look at the first century, they even admit, you go into the Holy of Holies, there was nothing in there. The Ark of the Covenant wasn't there. It was gone. It was an empty room. God's presence wasn't in there. Shekinah glory wasn't there. It was just an empty room with nothing inside of it, including God's presence. Well, why? Because His Son was walking around the face of the earth. Oh, and by the way, who was in the tabernacle that Moses built? Who was it? Was it the Father? No. It was the guy that everybody calls Jesus, Yeshua. The Yahweh that walked the face of the earth. But anyway, back to this. It says, for every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. Therefore, it is necessary that this one also have something to offer. For if he were of the earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve the copy and shadow of the heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle. For he said, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown to you on the mountain. So he's saying, yeah, it's true. Jesus wasn't the priest walking the earth, and you know, he wouldn't be serving in there right now if he was here now, but he is in the tabernacle of heaven, and yours is just a copy of where he actually is. All right. It says that every priest has to have something to offer in verse 3, the end of verse 3. Hebrews 9:19, let's take a look and let's see what sacrifice that Jesus had to offer, what his was. Hebrews 9:19 says, for when Moses had spoken every precept to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and goats with water, scarlet wool, and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, this is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you. And likewise, he sprinkled with the blood both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry. And according to the law, almost all things are purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. I'm going to come back to this point, but I don't want to break it up. I'm going to keep reading, but I'm going to come back to this. Verse 22. It says, verse 23, it says, therefore it was necessary that the copy of the things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. So he's saying, you know, your copy needs to be purified with blood of animals, but the actual one, the one that's in heaven, it needs a better sacrifice than the blood that we sprinkle around in here on the earth. It needs something of far more value. All of the sins, or almost all of the sins, require the shedding of blood. And that was the purpose of the, you know, it's the most apparent that people look at. Even people today read about this, they say, oh yeah, the tabernacle, sacrifices and killing and blood. And, you know, some people are very much against that. They join groups like PETA. Can you imagine? I think they'll start up sacrificing again before Jesus returns. Can you imagine the groups like PETA when this happens? Well, they're going to go ballistic. They're going to go nuts. Other Christians are very much against it because they think, well, that would undo what Jesus did. We can't have that. I grew up in a church that kept the Sabbath, but their supposed prophet said when she was alive that Israel would never again exist as a nation. It was very anti-Jewish. Well, she was shown false in 1948, but definitely never sacrifices, never, you know. And most Christian organizations hold to that line because they think somehow that undoes what Jesus did, because they don't understand. Verse 24, it says, "For Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Not that he should offer himself often, as the high priest enters the most holy place every year with blood of another. He would then have to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But now, once as the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And as it is appointed for men to die once, but after this the judgment, so Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. To those who eagerly wait for him, he will appear a second time apart from sin for salvation." Now back to the part in verse 22 about almost all things are purified with the blood, and without the shedding of blood there is no remission. The interesting thing to me is all the people that want to say that, you know, all these, you know, normally it's lumped into a group called ceremonial law, although I can't find that in the Bible. Some commentators put it in, publishers put it in headers, but it's not part of the Bible. It's just something that the publishing houses add. In the text of the Bible, there's no, these are the ceremonial laws. These are the ones we ignore. The same people that tell you that everything is, or great portions of the law are changed, altered, or abolished, are the same ones that claim right off the beginning when you say, but you're a sinner, you deserve to die. Yeah, but Jesus died for my sins. Oh, wait a minute. You mean the law that requires blood for sin? Part of this ceremonial law back here in the Old Testament? You're saying that the reason that you can be forgiven is because Jesus died for your sin? So that means that that law, that old ceremonial law requiring blood for sin, it's still valid because you're pointing to him. If it's not valid, you can't point to him. Well, maybe we'll let that one stand. That and tithing, that's two. There's so much in the Bible that's there for us to learn from, to get insight from, to develop a relationship with our Father. Think about somebody you know that you love right now. Might be the person, hopefully it's the person you're sitting next to. What if you found out that you didn't know anything at all about that person? It was all a lie. Say, what kind of a relationship? You'd question the relationship that you had. You say, we didn't really have a relationship. This was all pretend. It's all a lie. I don't know anything about you. Well, let me ask you on the flip side. If you want a real relationship with your Savior, don't you need to know the real things about him? Shouldn't there be that be our goal, to understand these things? We're never going to get them all. You're never going to know everything about somebody, the person you're sitting next to. You're never going to know it all. I don't care who you are. Most people think, well, if I let them know everything about me, they won't love me anymore. They already know enough bad stuff as it is. I can't really tell. The tabernacle in the wilderness was a picture of a greater and more perfect tabernacle. The high priest that served in that tabernacle in the wilderness and then later in Israel and then later in the temple was just a picture of the greater and more perfect tabernacle that our Savior serves in today. Somebody says, you wonder what Jesus is doing today? Well, he's doing multiple things. But one of the things he's doing today, if you want to know something, take a look at what the high priest does today. That's what he's doing today, along with many other things. But the more you know, you say, well, I don't care about that part of it. Oh, really? That part of it has your salvation linked to it. That's like saying, well, I really love this man or I really love this woman, but I don't want to know anything about that part of her. Now, granted, you might not talk about it every day, but you at least got to know about that part of them to really know the person. When we study the first tabernacle, then what a better time, really? Realistically, can you think of a better time to talk about the first tabernacle? If you're going to talk, now there's a lot of things I could have chosen to talk about today, but maybe the tabernacle in the wilderness is an appropriate thing, because I really did. I started out, I was going to talk about our bodies and tabernacling and, you know, the standard sermons that you get. And I'm hoping that, you know, we still go through those, because those are good. That's good material. And the things that every one of us need to know. So I thought, you know, you don't hear a lot about the tabernacle, the real one, that exists today up in heaven, and then the copy out in the wilderness at the Feast of Tabernacles. But it's the most appropriate place and time to bring it up. Because really, when you go through the sermons that talk about what it all symbolizes, and we'll go through those this week while we're here, it helps if you understand a little bit, okay, this is what it symbolizes, but it's trying to think of something that something represents without looking at the real thing. To get the concept of what it represents, you got to look at the original. You got to look at the real tangible asset. And that's what Christianity does. They can talk about, well, this represents this and this represents this, but then they just kick out this actual thing that God gave us in history that was supposed to teach us something. It's like trying to learn a lesson by rejecting the foundation of what the lesson is built off of. It don't work. And that's why, quite honestly, we're so screwed up. Because it represented everything. Everything that was any of importance and everything that was good. You can't understand the purpose of the heavenly tabernacle without looking at the physical one, because that's what God gave us, mankind, so that we could try and get a concept of what's going on in the heavenly. We can't, if we don't know anything about the earthly tabernacle, we're not even going to get started. It's like going to, what's that big motorcycle? Sturgis. Where's Sturgis? Is that South Dakota? Who knows anything about Sturgis? Is that South Dakota? It's like going to Sturgis in South Dakota for the motorcycle rally, and you've never ridden a motorcycle or even seen one in your whole life. How much are you going to get out of going to this big, I think it's the biggest motorcycle rally in this country. You see it on television, you see all kinds. I don't really care to go there. I've never been there, don't want to. But that's what we do. So if we go to the Feast of Tabernacles, but we've never looked at the tabernacle, how much are you going to get out of it? How are you going to understand it? Most people, let's take a look at Exodus. Exodus chapter 25, verse 8. Now I'm going to give you an answer here. I said I'm not going to give you a bunch of answers, but I'm going to give you one answer. The answer I'm going to give you is why God commanded that they make the tabernacle in the first place. It was for a very specific reason. Here's the answer, Exodus 25:8. It says, "And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them." It's not real hard to understand. It says in verse 9, "According to all that I show you that is in the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings, just so you shall make it." The reason for the tabernacle in the wilderness, the main reason, it's multifaceted, but the main one is so God could dwell with his people. Okay? That you can get some insight. Did he really need a house? You know, when they wanted to make a permanent building for them, He had questions about, you know, is there anything you can make to contain me? But he said he wanted a place to dwell among his people. So think about it, the things that they did. Now, I'm not downplaying, it was beautiful, but they take some animal skins and some precious metals and some wood, and they build this thing. It's basically, it's a tent. It's a really fancy tent, and God is inside of it. His presence is there. We read about how Moses goes in and talks to him face to face and all these things. And I think a lot of times people concentrate on that. Oh, this is, God is, hey, see that? You know, we want to say, if you're witnessing to somebody and you're telling them about something, wouldn't you be able to say, well, you see that tent right over there? That place, see those men walking around outside and the smoke going up off that altar? The God that created the ground you're standing on is inside of there. Okay? And there's nothing wrong with that, but I think even more important than that, that sounds impressive to other people, but God desired something. He wanted them to make a tent for him so that he could dwell with his people. You see, sometimes we forget that aspect. He wanted to be with them. Think about it for a minute. I'm not a farmer, I don't own a farm, but if I owned a ranch or something and I had 500 cattle, now some people I'm sure own it, like Ted Turner, and they might never even see it. You know, he's got a lot more than 500. But wouldn't you want to go out and say, these are my cows? Maybe you'd even give a few of them a name. I know I spent a few summers when I was growing up with my grandfather's brother. He had a farm. My cousin, he called these, you know, when it's time to go milk the cows, they had 300-400 cows. They did it in two cycles to get them all in their barn. But he'd be, yeah, come on, Betsy, and he'd swat them in the butt, and he'd get them in there, and he's bringing them in from the out in the area where they had them all fenced in right outside the barn in the morning, and, you know, he's calling them all. I said, how do you know all these? They all look the same to me. And he says, oh, I don't know. I just call them whatever. But you'd want to see them. If you owned them, they were yours, you'd want to spend time with them. You'd have some pride in it. And God, I think, had pride too. This was his people. The reason I say that is there's an example in Job where Satan comes before him and he says, have you seen my servant Job? See, some of these attributes that we have were created in his image. So I'm not saying that God is exactly like us, but I'm saying you can see bits and pieces of him through us because we are done in his image. And he does like it, love it, when the only thing he asks of his people, his children, is that they love him. Really simple. And when some of his children do actually love him and do things that are pleasing in his sight, it makes him feel good. And because of that, he wanted to be there with them. Now, that's not such a hard concept to get. But that was only 2,000 years ago, right? Because God let the temple be destroyed in 70 AD and nothing like it has existed since then. We're coming up, it's almost 2,000 years. And he hasn't dwelt among his people. He's got no desire to do this, right? Remember, this is the guy that does not change. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. So let me ask the question. He's got no desire to do something like this again, right? Wrong, thank you. Most people actually think that God has no use for us. I'm not lumping all of you in the same group, most people, but I'm just talking about in the world. realistically, at least my view of the world, is they don't really see the need that God has for us. And I see He has a need. It's not just like this experiment with Him, where you order a kid off the internet for the ant farm, and then you go out and you collect some ants and put them in your ant farm, and it's just this big experiment. You watch it and you see it grow. Maybe today on computers they buy a sim program and create societies, and you know, it's not like this, wow, look at this, oh, look what happens over here, let me tweak this a little bit. Oh, you see them all going crazy now? It's not this big experiment like that. God actually has a need and a desire, and He's doing this for a purpose. They think He's eternal. Well, yeah, He is. Self-sustaining. Yes, He is. He doesn't need us for that. He's not going to die without us. He lives outside of our dimension and views the world as His property. Well, in a way it is. It's His. But you know what? He's given control of it over to His arch enemy to accomplish something. The Bible describes a Creator who longs to be our Father. It's constantly reaching out to those that could be His children, redeeming them and forgiving them. In the garden, Jesus dwelt with Adam and walked with him. When Adam ate from the tree of life, and mankind fell, you think God was happy or He grieved? Now, granted, I understand He knew it was going to happen, but yet, you think He didn't care? Or you think He grieved? God made Adam's heart perfect. He created him from the inside out, just like He created each one of us. Adam chose, for whatever reasons, and we can get into all of the theories and, oh, well, Eve ate it and he was so much in love with Eve, and, you know, whatever. Whatever the reasons, Adam chose to do something he knew was wrong and reject God's way. And he was removed from the garden where he could have lived forever. The tabernacle of the wilderness is where Jesus chose to dwell the first time with mankind before he came as a human being. One of the things he chooses to live in a clean place. A lot of the instructions were what is holy and what is unholy and what can be done and what can't be done. And it was all to keep it not only physically clean, but ritually clean also, because this was his home. Now, sometimes I say things that offends a lot of people, and I don't necessarily do that, you know, just to make somebody mad, like, ha, watch from this one, I'm going to get this one. But there are things that could be done to each one of us that would make us feel like somebody came in and defiled our home. I actually had a rabbi, his name was Chaim Richman, give me this example one time when he was trying to describe to me how God feels when somebody defiles his home. He said, suppose I came into your house, walked into your kitchen, climbed up on your kitchen table, took my pants down, and left you something, I won't go to exactly how he put it, but left you something, a present on your table, where you sit and you eat and you commune with your family. He says, how would that make you feel? I know some people, the table would go out the door, never to return, completely defiled. They would never be able to sit at that table and eat, no matter how much, you know, toxic cleansers and everything else. And Julie's shaking her head, yes, the table would be out of the house, never to be used again. Because no matter what that crossed the, it just unclean, impure, and unusable forever. When we do things against God, that's how he feels sometimes. Now, it's so, there's one thing that can atone for that and make up for that, because each one of us has done the equivalent of that to God. And that's the most precious thing he possessed in the entire universe. And oh, by the way, he owns it all, is the life of his son that came in to make those atonements for our sins so that we can be forgiven. But we got to know what's biblically clean and unclean. We have to know what's ritually pure and impure. We've got, you know, if we want some understanding into God, we need to know what he says. And one of the places we can start is when it comes to his tabernacle. Take a look at Exodus chapter 19, verse 4. Because before he commanded that the tabernacle be built, he cleaned or cleansed his people that were going to build it. It says, "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine." Then, when he gets done talking about this, you know, starting out with, "You've seen what I've done for you." I've got a covenant for you, so that you can be special above all of the people of the earth, because I own them all. But I want to offer you something that makes you different from all the others. He gives them the Ten Commandments in chapter 20. This is God's pattern. And it happens over and over again. First, he delivers you by grace. You know, it's not because, what did he say he chose Israel? Because they were the richest and the most powerful and the most handsome and beautiful. And no, he said they were the least. Nobody else would want them. And that's why he chose them, because when he did something great with them, then all the other people would say, "Who is this God that you worship?" But this pattern is over and over. First, he delivers you by his grace, and then he gives you instructions so that he can use you. First, he gets your intention, and then he tells you, if we're going to go any further, this is what's got to be done. Anybody have that happen in their life? You don't have to raise your hand. I mean, just think about this in your own head. People say, "Well, why me?" all the time. What's his plan? I don't know what God's got in store for me. I don't know. But the very first thing he does is he didn't pick you because of who you are. He picked you because of what you could become. And after he picks you and gets your attention, then he shows you some things. And now it depends on what you do, if you're willing, if you really love him, that whether or not he's going to use you at all. Adam's created perfect. Then he's given instructions. You can eat from this tree, don't eat from this one, you know, tend the garden. Noah finds grace in the Lord, eyes of the Lord, and then he's given some instructions. Build an ark. Israel is born on eagle's wings, and then they're given some instructions. Now keep on going, and here comes to you in your own personal story. When we become a child of God, we're given instructions from our Father. Isn't it odd that most of the world wants to throw out two-thirds of the instructions that he's given us? It should never be a question of whether the children of God should obey the instructions. A true child of God is expected because of love. You know, you can never really get your children to do things because they're afraid that you're going to beat them. Never really. Some people say, "Oh, okay, I just beat it out of them." But even if you can get them to accomplish a task because they're afraid of getting beaten, everything you do, every interaction with you, it's like they think that you're going to get hit again. It's automatic. That's not how God wants us. Yeah, he's got some penalties, but he doesn't want us to do something because if we don't do it, he's going to whack us. He wants us to do it because we love him. When a husband does something for his wife that's special, not because he's in trouble or she's in trouble, the wife does something for her husband because she's in trouble, they do it because they love them. That's when the true meaning is there. When the other one says, well, what's going on here? Well, I love you. And they know that just not, you know, strings attached or, you know, okay, what is it that you really want that you did this? It's truly out of love. That's what God desires from us. Just like we have those feelings and those desires and those wants, it comes because we're created in his image. Let's look at how this plays out. Turn to chapter 24 of Exodus. Because here God calls people and then he cleanses them and he brings them into a covenant relationship. Exodus 24 verse 5, it says, then he sent young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in the basins, and half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has said we will do, and be obedient. And Moses took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, this is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you according to these words. He brought them, he had them out into the wilderness, and now he offers them the covenant. Now the covenant, in order for them to be cleaned up, required blood. So blood was part of it, but that wasn't the end of all ends. You know, God doesn't desire to be the CEO of Oscar Mayer, Jimmy Dean, and all of the other meatpacking plants in the world. That's not what he really likes. You smell that smoke? Now it says it is a pleasing aroma to God, but who has ever smelled burning flesh? I'm not even talking about a steak on the grill. I'm talking about, I was a volunteer firefighter, I don't know, about 5 years. I have smelled, 37 years ago, I have smelled burning flesh. I have been into a house where people were inside of it and died in the fire. Let me tell you something, there's nothing worse than that smell. If you take an animal and you throw it up, you think it smells bad in your kitchen when something burns in the oven, or on the grill when your steak is burned. It's not pleasant, but that's nothing compared, like the burnt offering was the complete animal. Yes, they cut it, they cleanse it, they wash it, but the entire animal went up on the altar and was burnt. And somehow, I drive back out past Outback Steakhouse and go, oh, that smells good. But if they had the entire animal and they were burning it up to nothing, not good. I've been past meatpacking plants and they ain't even cooking it in there. Not good. But these are all God's possessions, and all of these animals are being offered every day. And he says it's a pleasing aroma to his nostrils. So what's really going on here? What's the purpose of it? He likes his meat well done. I mean, really well done, crispy critter. No. The love, the obedience, the sacrifice, the worship that was going on, it was pleasing to his nostrils because he knew the people were down there doing these things because they loved him. And it talks about it going up to heaven. So now, back in Exodus 24, now that he's cleansed this people, gets their attention, he calls them, he brings them out into the wilderness, then he cleanses them, he offers them a deal, he offers them a ketubah, a covenant, a relationship with him. Now in Exodus 25 verse 1, he instructs them, after all of this has taken place, then he instructs them to build him a place to dwell. Exodus 25:1 says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, that they bring me an offering. From everyone who gives it willingly with his heart, you shall take my offering. And this is the offering which you shall take from them, gold, silver, and bronze, purple, blue, and scarlet thread, fine linen and goat's hair, ram skins dyed red, badger skins," I know there's different translations, different animals, "but badger skins and acacia wood, oil for the light and spices for the anointing oil, for the sweet incense, onyx stones and stones to be set in the ephod on the breastplate, and let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. According to all that I show you that is in the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of its furnishings, just so you shall make it." Then, at that point, after the covenant relationship is offered, then he tells them, make me a tent so that I can dwell with you. Over and over, these patterns are used in the Bible. God instructs us from the most holy place outward. Where does he live? In the tabernacle in heaven. Where is his throne? It's in the Holy of Holies. Where's the Messiah? Where's Jesus? On his right. On the right of his throne, which is in the Holy of Holies. Where does the high priest dwell when he approaches God? He enters the Holy of Holies. Did it once a year only here on earth. And if you look at what's happened in history, a lot of them fell over dead because of the motive in their hearts. The people were evil. When things were going good and the people were good, the high priest would go in, he'd minister, he'd complete on the Day of Atonement, and he'd walk out alive. When things weren't so good, they hauled him out on the rope that they tied around his ankle because he fell over dead in the presence of God. But he shows us what's holy, what's righteous, and he begins with the holy place, the most holy place, the Holy of Holies. Even when it gets down to the tabernacle and the furnishings and everything, where does he start? He starts with what? Does anybody remember? He starts with the Ark of the Covenant. He starts with this piece of furniture, really fancy furniture, right? But it serves a purpose. It's got his mercy seat on it, and he dwells above the mercy. He starts with that, and then he goes out with the instructions, and he describes the rest of it. It's sort of like you've got this treasured piece of furniture, a special couch or chair or something, and you build the house around it. The most important piece is right there in the middle, and the rest of it is built around this most important piece, and that's where you're going to spend all your time. But the tabernacle is divided into three areas. The most holy place, or the Holy of Holies. The holy place. And the court. So we got the Holy of Holies, the holy place, and the court. In our tabernacle, how could this relate to us? Because somebody is going to bring all of this stuff up, and we're going to talk about the tabernacles that we possess. Might be me, might be somebody else, I don't know. But we've got a most holy place. It's our heart. Anybody think their heart isn't the most important thing? And the heart really represents your emotions, your... Take it out and see how long you're around. The rest of the body basically surrounds the heart so that it can pump and give you the oxygen and the nutrients. But it talks about our hearts, the hearts of men. God searches the hearts of men in the Bible. The holy place is our mind. And the court is our physical body. In the physical tabernacle, the most holy place, there was only one thing inside of it, physical thing. The ark that contained the mercy seat where God dwelt. Only one person was allowed to enter it. The Messiah, Jesus. Turn to Revelation chapter 3, verse 20. I'm going to end here. And I want to ask you, who do you allow in the most holy place of your tabernacle? The heart represents your emotions, your desires, your feelings, what motivates you. You know, the mind can represent a lot of other things, the things that you let in, the things you watch, the things you read, the things you see and do. But the heart really is the strongest of even over the mind, because a pure heart can clean up a polluted mind. Now, if you pollute your court, your body, you can be defiled. If you pollute your mind, you can be defiled. If you pollute your heart, unless it changes, it's game over. Revelation 3:20 says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in to him and dine with him and he with me." We all know what this is talking about. While you're here this week, picturing what the Feast of Tabernacle pictures, trying to put it together and say, what meaning does this have for me? How many miles, Brenda, did you travel? 2,500 miles. I think you win the prize this year. 2,500 miles you traveled to get here so that you could do something. It wasn't to see your family. Well, okay. But Brianna was closer than 2,500 miles. And, and it would have been cheaper just to say, here's a plane ticket. Bryce can kick it off. And, you came here for a reason. And it wasn't just to see me or see other people that you haven't seen for a while. You wouldn't have gone that far just to do that. You came here for a reason. It's got to mean something. Because if it doesn't get anything out of it, and if it doesn't mean something, you're not going to do it anymore. Anywhere. See, God tells you to keep the Feast of Tabernacles for a reason. Now, you can do it just out of, okay, he says it, I'll do it. But I don't know anybody that does that forever, over and over and over forever, when they don't get something out of it that makes it real for them and has understanding and draws them close to God. I'm going to give you a hint. He told the children of Israel to give their offering to the priests so that they could build him a tent, so that he could dwell with them. The real purpose for dwelling with them is so that he could be in their midst. Notice he chose for the tabernacle. Think about this. Everybody around you can pollute it. And this, last week or the week before, we went through some of the things in Knoxville about how it was defiled. The people and the land and everything was defiled. And so everything in the tabernacle in the wilderness, everybody, surrounded by Levi. And then beyond Levi, north, south, east, and west, there's three tribes in each direction. Anybody in any of those tribes and anywhere can defile it and make it like somebody comes into your kitchen and leaves you a present on your table. Why do you take that risk? Because the desire for love and to have a relationship with your children and for them to love you and serve you, it's not some make-believe thing. It's not some far concept, a theory that we're just supposed to grab and accept. It's a real live experience where you have a real live relationship. And he was willing to come and live amongst his children so that that could happen. That's the reason you're here today. we're supposed to look back and talk about the 40 years in the wilderness and tabernacling among men and all of that. It's not just to remember all this bad time because of the spies that gave the evil report, so it cost them 40 years. It's so that we could see how much God desires to have a relationship with us, and that is the most important thing that you can accomplish at any time in your entire life. We do things because He says it, but that's just like the ritual part of it. We got to get past that. Like Jesus said in John 14, 15, if you love me, keep my commandments. Keep them out of love. And in order to do it out of love, there has to be a relationship there. If the relationship in a marriage, if that relationship dies, it's got to get fixed. If you can't fix it, if there goes something wrong with it and you can't fix it, that marriage is over. And even if the two people stay together, it's just pure hell because there's no relationship. It ain't there. So above all things, you gotta kindle that relationship. You have the right to be a child of God. That's your right, your destiny. Claim your right. Get down on your knees and start the relationship. Everybody, I don't care who you are, the fire's died down. Now's the time for the bonfire, the holy days. Pile the wood on. If it's down to coals and you can't even see the embers, dust off, blow off some of the dust, the coal, and start getting down a little deeper, poke a little hole in there and start blowing where there's still a little bit of, you're here, there's got to be a little bit of a, at the very least, there's a little bit of a kindling. It's hot and down, deep down inside. Throw some kindling on it and start blowing. You need God's Holy Spirit, His breath, His power, and get that fire going again. For His children, He loves us. And oh, by the way, wherever two or three are gathered, there I am in the midst of them. He's here with us. So let's sing this song and pray this prayer that's coming up like we really mean it, like we really want it. And I'm asking them, and my prayer is the same for you. You all have your own individual prayers, but I'm asking them to show me more about them so that I can understand them more and I can have a closer relationship. And my prayer is that He does that for everybody that's here, because we all need it. That's why we're here. We can have a vacation anytime we want. You just take the time off or walk away from whatever and go somewhere. But this isn't a vacation. He's called us to assemble together so that He can show us His love and what He has in store for us so we can be His children.